Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
From the Fox News Radio studios in New York City, giving you opinions and facts with a positive approach, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, closing out a horrific week. If you look at Lavaldi, what happened at that elementary school over in Texas, still trying to piece it together. That'll be the focus of a lot of the show. Jack Carr is the number one New York Times bestselling author of and a Navy SEAL. His latest book is called In the Blood, a thriller. It's his fifth, and that's going to be great. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North is standing by to bring some perspective, not only what's happening here domestically, but other things that are happening, for example, in the Ukraine. He's been about on every war zone, really, since Vietnam, that America has been involved with. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
What we now have is a very clear pattern in both the Steele dossier and the Alpha Bank scandal. Both of them originated with the Clinton campaign. When it went over to the FBI, apparently, according to this agent, James Comey and the rest of the FBI were chomping at the bit.
What does that mean for the overall case? The Durham trial wraps up today. Defendant Michael Sussman decides not to take the stand. What we know because of his trial and what are Durham's chances of conviction? Is there any justice? Is there any chance Sussman should be the first of many to go down? It seems like a layup, but nothing is a lock with that D.C. jury.
Number two.
We are going to extend a hand of partnership to those who have been sitting on the sidelines, to those who have chosen to side with the gun lobby.
I think there's a sense of urgency that maybe we didn't feel before. We're going to try to work through this and see if we can find that common ground.
Senator John Cornyn says it's time to look at guns and school safety. Bipartisan talks underway through Memorial Day. What are the chances and what should happen, if anything? I'll offer my views and get it from the colonel, too.
Number one.
Multiple witnesses that I spoke with said as soon as they heard gunshots, they immediately jumped in a car, got to Robb Elementary, and that's where they were met with law enforcement. They couldn't get into the school. Multiple parents tell me that they were frustrated by law enforcement inaction and don't understand why it took so long to get to the shooter.
Jorge Ventura of the Daily Caller. The Daily Caller. Funerals begin for the 19 grade schoolers and two teachers who lost their lives this week. But what I know now about the timeline and what you should know, too, about the killer, we will elaborate. And we've been told a lot of mistruths over the last few days. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North has seen it all. The worst to battle, the best to battle. Big wins, big losses. And he's got a new book coming out, Tragic Consequences, The Price America is Paying for Rejecting God and How to Reclaim Our Culture for Christ. You check it out on faithfultext.com. Colonel, welcome back. Great to hear from you.
Brian, great to hear you on the air. I caught you just a few minutes ago on TV, and here you are doing 3 hours of radio. No one up there working harder than you are and getting the word out straight.
Well, thanks. I'm doing our best to piece together some of the facts. And I want to talk about the big picture and also get your take, because we have not spoken about Ukraine, just about this operation and why I believe it's important for us to do everything for them to be successful. I'll get your view in a moment. But I was shocked to hear some of how much has been told to us that was wrong since the shooting in Uvalde. Your take from what we know.
Well, first, I think there's a lot more incompetence and misfeasance than there is malfeasance in that. And I say that just because it's a small town. I've been through it I'll bet a half a dozen times when I was traveling down in Texas. And I was born in San Antonio, which is the biggest city close enough to Uvalde. And it's a little town you go through on the way to Fredericksburg to go to the museum out there. I don't think those are intentional. I think it's a lot of misinformation, not necessarily generated by someone with intent. And so I look at what transpired in that school, and I'm drawn to several conclusions,
okay. Even
with what we know. One, it took way too long to get to the shooter. Number two, there was almost apparently no operational security that was in place out there. Number three, you've got, quite frankly, an attack on an elementary school was not in the planning of anybody, apparently. And so, yeah, it took 4 minutes or 5 minutes, whatever it was, to get police on the scene. But then it took another over an hour, I guess. I was looking at the timeline that you guys had up this
yeah.
morning. And it's still guessing at how many minutes it took for people to move around inside the building. So, you know, without getting into the morality, I do want to get into that as we talk about it, because it's directly related to the book. And we didn't, by the way, the book was long planned to come out in May, because it's election season officially begins with primary season. Primary season is in May, and that's why we brought the book out in May. It had nothing to do with the expectation we're going to have three mass murders, you know, wild gunmen in the space of 11 days. But
okay, yeah.
If I look at the mechanics of what you got to do, what we're not doing, and I'm not bragging or complaining, when I was president of the NRA, we had a program called School Shield. It was based on military theory of how you protect things, okay? And it's a defense in depth. And it basically has four parts. First of all, you got to decide what your defensive zone is, if you're protecting a seaport or an airport or a military base. Number two, you got to have intelligence gathered about what the threat really is. Number three, you've got to be able to intercept the threat between where the threat's coming from and trying to get to. And number four, you've got to have point defense, the kind of protections that means somebody's got a firearm out of their holster or on their shoulder, engaging the adversary. Now, those are four things that are fairly complex if you don't know what you're doing. We were actually running the program. It started in 2012, even before I became president of the NRA. And I would like to see it still being advocated. I don't know that it is. I got fired over there. That's a different issue. And the bottom line of it, those kinds of techniques will protect a place. You just got to decide politically whether you're going to allocate the resources necessary, and most of it's money. The fact is, if you're going to harden a school to protect the kids inside it and the teachers, then you're going to have to do things like lock the doors. You got to have the ability to electronically shut things down. You got to have the ability to have the cops be able to open a door if the bad guy's inside killing kids, like this guy was. All those kinds of things have to be taken into consideration, and you need experts at it. A lot of people don't even know this, but the Secret Service, working with the Department of Education, way back in, I think it was 2002 or 3, put together an actual operational plan for how you go about protecting kids in school. Nobody's paying attention to it. We've got hundreds of billions of dollars that were allocated that haven't been spent yet from the COVID stuff. Some of it was supposed to go through for K-12 education. I'm told there's a boatload of it. So,
right.
My suggestion very quickly is what you do is you reopen the what was recommended either by the NRA or by the Secret Service and the Department of Education. Number two, put the money into it. Number three, in addition to arming people inside schools to protect kids, that's the point defense people. You can't just wait for the folks to show up from town. If the cops aren't in the school resource officers, it's going to take too long to get there. I don't care where you are.
So they say nationally 19% of elementary schools have an armed officer, 45% of middle schools, and 67% of high schools. But
right.
But I'll tell you what, you could have the most sophisticated or rudimentary security plan. But if this is the case, we got a problem. Here's the Texas Department of Public Safety Regional Director, Victor Escalon.
So right now, you know, during the investigation, it appears it was unlocked. So we're going to look at that and try to corroborate that as best as we can.
And you have a high school, excuse me, a grammar school with the doors unlocked.
Right.
My goodness. Not only is there not an officer, but it's an unlocked school. I don't remember last time I went to pick up anybody at school, and there wasn't one entrance in and one entrance out anywhere.
Look, we protect our airports, our banks, our government buildings. The Fox News headquarters in New York has better protection than an elementary school down the street. Think about that. When we came into the building, whether I was working out of Washington or working out of New York, there's armed guards down in the lobby. They don't wave their guns around. But you can't get through that lobby without the proper ID or a note from somebody saying, Brian Kilmeade, St. Ollie North's coming in to see me, right? How the hell is it that we've got schools that are wide open? I want to add one more thing to what I recommended, okay? I would recommend that if you want to be able to use role models as good examples, human beings learn best when they are shown something rather than reading about it or watching a video. Fact of life. I would like to see a program to hire, let's say, pick a number, 250,000 veterans who would be in schools, whether they're disabled or whether they're whatever, who would be in schools to be mentors, to be counselors, to be the kinds of people. Here we are. This is you know, Memorial Day we're talking about. And I'm going to recommend this at the Heroes Festival down in Daytona when I get down there on Saturday. I would like to see 250,000 veterans in the schools as mentors, counselors, coaches, and the kinds of people who are alert enough to see something that's not right and do something about it. I'm not saying they don't all have to be armed. Some of them probably should be. I would like to see more of that kind of point defense capability in the school already.
Well, a couple of things, Colonel. There's one thing that's pretty clear. We have to be able to harden every target, the smallest and biggest school. And if there's ever a national program that you kind of mentioned, that there is money there, pandemic or not, the American people can get behind Republicans and Democrats, it's that. And many people point to the fact that you remember skyjacking. And that was skyjacking was happening like 11 a year for a long time. Well, we decided we're going to not allow that to happen. And thankfully, it doesn't happen now. Now, you know, sadly, we still have some blown out of the sky, and we saw it happen on 9/11. That's the same thing that's got to happen. There's a national sentiment to support that, and I would love to see a hardening of that. And why not? If there's not enough retired cops, I think we're military, coming out of the military, especially now as we wind down two wars, which are done, but we might have to go back in someday. Why not just make them the first hire to go into the schools, big and small, and be capable of, you know, go through the training for this specific operation to be able, two of them in every school.
At least two. Yeah. I mean, it depends on the size of the school.
And let every killer know. If you're going to try for a school, that's a death sentence. Right away.
We put up a sign outside the school. It's a big yellow sign. It says, gun-free zone.
And that means attack.
That's what makes crazies, like the three that, you know, committed these massacres over the course of the last, 12 days? I mean,
right.
It's unbelievable.
So what makes you think, or you know, you write this book, Tragic Consequences, The Price America's Paying for Rejecting God and How to Reclaim Our Culture for Christ, and you can check it out on faithfultext.com. What do you mean America is rejecting God? We're supposed to have a separation between church and state, right?
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. Look, it began in 1962. The case is Engel versus Vitale. It was an upstate New York lawsuit. Engel was the person who wanted to get rid of prayer in school. And so they did. In 1962, I was in the last high school class in America where you could actually graduate saying a prayer. Almighty God, we thank you for your support for us. We beg your blessings on us, our parents, our teachers, and our school. It's almost exactly what the prayer was. That's 62. 1973, Roe versus Wade. Roe versus Wade is more than a cultural degradation. It's a part of driving God out of the lives of the American people. And what you got is not just infanticide, it launched an assault on the sanctity of human life, polarized our politics, and results in threats against conservative justices. All of that is a consequence, it's driving to the tragic consequence of a nation that no longer regards God to be part of their day-to-day lives. Every time I hear someone like that congressman who wrote off to Ted Cruz and several other people using profane language, by the way, a former Marine, which is really painful. He's an Arizona congressman. I don't even want to use his name. He writes off to people using profane and vulgar language and talks about effing prayers. Okay? Now, let me just tell you something. That's the kind of thing that's got to stop in this country. That's the kind of thing that has driven people over the brink. Today, we've got people who pretend to be God because they're multi-bazillionaires, and God is not happy. And what this book offers is a solution. In every chapter, there's what you can do about it. I'd like to take the congressman aside and just ask him, what did you expect to happen in America when you drove God out of our schools, our public gatherings, the media, the entertainment world? What did you expect the outcome was going to be? Because we're seeing it. It's much more than simply the issue of a Supreme Court decision. It is the people of America who have got to get back down. And look, I'm an old man. Somebody asked me, why did you write this book? I'm an old man. I've got 18 grandkids. I'm selfish about their future. For the first time in my life, concerned that this nation may not survive as it is. And I wanted to leave behind something that they could look at and say, that was my granddad. He taught me. He didn't He didn't just talk about it.
Right.
He showed me,
believe me,
how to fight the good fight, finish the race, and keep the faith.
You're a great example for everybody 365 days a year, let alone people you're related to. But I'm going to close out to somebody. The NRA kind of went south when you went in there and tried to fix it. They didn't like that. They decided they're going to have to get rid of Oliver North, and they've gone down south ever since. Should they be having a conference in Houston today?
Well, I mean, there is a membership out there. The membership needs to be supported. Those used to be wonderful extravaganzas. I understand it's much smaller than it used to be. I think something's got to change. The country needs an NRA. Let's keep it that way. It needs something to support the Second Amendment and do the kinds of training and safety programs that the NRA was doing for years. The NRA also needs to be able to go out there and raise money to do things like School Shield.
I'm just talking about the timing of it, Colonel.
But it was, remember, you can't book a venue in America. It's 2 weeks out. You've got to book it, months out.
Gotcha.
And the thing was booked in Houston way before. I know that, look, there's people down in Texas right now that are saying the reason all this happened is the NRA is here. That's
totally.
That's the
we know that. That's crap.
Well, of course that. But Colonel, as you and I both know, it's more than a political issue.
Colonel Oliver North, we didn't get to Ukraine, but we got to more important stuff about the future of America. It's all in your book, Tragic Consequences, The Price America is Paying for Rejecting God and How to Reclaim Our Culture for Christ. Colonel North, thanks so much.
Thank you, brother. Semper Fi.
Yeah, back at you, and I will hopefully see you soon. When we come back, it's your time to talk. I'll go over the timeline a little bit more on what we know. We're going to get more details within our show. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It was reported that a school district police officer confronted the suspect that was making entry. Not accurate. He walked in unobstructed initially. So from the grandmother's house to the bar ditch to the school, into the school, he was not confronted by anybody.
And that was the most stunning news I got out of everything. And it's not so much the fact, it's the fact that we were told something totally different, that he was confronted, or was the shooter, the 18-year-old, by an armed guard who was able to confront him, get a shot off, and able to drop a bag full of ammo, or it could have been so much worse. It turns out to be total fiction. Who's responsible for that story and continue to tell that story for at least a day or two is nuts. I'm used to the fog of war. One person was in, two person was in, one person had a gun, too. I'm used to that. But not a whole fictional confrontation at somebody's, I guess some cop show they watched the night before. Bottom line is 19 kids dead, two teachers, 15, 17 were actually put into hospital. Most are expected to survive. The grandmother, who was shot in the face, also expected to survive. She has a lot of answers. She can't talk, but she can write. Hopefully she'll start helping us out to find out how this kid got so twisted how he was able to stay under the radar. Brian Kilmeade Show.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Multiple witnesses that I spoke with said as soon as they heard gunshots, they immediately jumped in a car, got to Robb Elementary, and that's where they were met with law enforcement. They couldn't get into the school. It got to a point where a group of parents actually huddled together and were game planning to go into that school. We've also learned that a mother was actually placed in handcuffs from federal marshals. We also know that a father was tased, attempting to grab his kid once his kid was on the bus. Multiple parents told me that they were frustrated by law enforcement inaction and don't understand why it took so long to get to the shooter.
And with about an hour, Jorge Ventura of the Daily Caller reporting that because we found out yesterday that there was no confrontation with the killer. He got in through an open door, and he was able to hang out in that classroom for an hour. But then we did get some amendments to that. For some reason, this wasn't made clear yesterday afternoon. The two officers went in, both were shot, one in the ear, one in the arm, and still hung in there for a while outside that door. Jack Carr knows all about the dangers in going into a room like that through of hostile actors. He's a former Navy SEAL. His latest book is In the Blood, a thriller. It's his fifth thriller in the Terminal List series. And Jack Carr joins us now. Welcome, Jack.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
So Jack, the Border Patrol, the Border Tech, was the ones who took this shooter down. They waited for them to arrive because evidently these cops weren't trained to handle a situation like this. They borrowed the U.S. Marshal's shield and they went in into a stack of, with a stack of four, maybe more. Do you need an expertise like the type you have and they have in order to be successful? Or is there another thing that an officer could do?
Well, it certainly helps, but it's really about that mindset. In an extremist situation, you run into the sound of the guns. And you think that most police officers have that. You think that most special operators have that in the military, especially when it's a hostage situation, which calls for going in and saving that hostage. That's what you have here. Of course, you have a barricaded shooter. But what we have is so much data to go back and look at and understand that, hey, history is probably going to repeat itself. So it's just a matter of time for this happens again, whether it's a shooter like this or it's terrorists. We go back to the Beslan school siege in September of 2004. That was 3 days where Chechen terrorists took over a school. Ended up over 300 people were killed in that. And that is something that could very well happen here. And why? Because our schools are soft targets. Our airports were soft targets. We fixed that after September 11th. We neglect to look at the pages of history, not in very recent history. 2004 wasn't that long ago. And we refuse for some reason to harden our schools. Israel has done it. They've been very successful in doing that. But we, for some reason, refuse to protect the softest targets among us. And it's unforgivable.
Right. 19% of elementary schools have an armed guard. They say 67% of high schools have them. What would it take for you to feel good about the school that somebody in your family was going to? How many guards? Would they be armed? Would teachers be armed?
Yeah. Yep. It all depends on the size of the school, obviously, how many students, how large a landmass that you're talking about there. So with those factors in mind, it's definitely armed guards with ARs, with that AR-type weapon system, because you will go to a place that is not as hard as that one if you're looking for a place to commit these crimes or commit an act of terrorism. So what Israel has done, they have that's what they have. And guess what? Their teachers, for the most part, also carry concealed. And for some reason, our teachers or our school districts, whatever it might be, they don't want to take that step. They just don't want to believe that they live in a world where that is necessary. And you know, I'll tell you what, for most of human history, it has been necessary to have these skills to defend yourself, to defend your family, defend your tribe. Only for a very small portion of human history have we been able to outsource these types of things and to think that we can call 911. But by its very nature, that means that the police are showing up afterward, after the crime has already been committed. So it's up to the quote-unquote victim to not be a victim, to be prepared and to protect themselves and to protect those in their care.
Jack Carr with me now, former Navy SEAL, New York Times bestseller, brand new book out called In the Blood, a thriller to continue on with this series. Just go over the timeline. 11:28, the killer arrives and crashes his truck. We don't know why. Then he gets up and indiscriminately fires at two people at a funeral home. And by the way, his grandmother called 911 after being shot in the face by this mutant. So then a 911 call comes in from the funeral home people, we assume. Ramos lingers outside the school for 12 minutes, firing shots before he gets into the school unobstructed. Jack, the door was open. 11:43, he goes into Robb Elementary School, and he starts going looking around for people to attack. He walks 30 feet down the tunnel. He walks another 20 feet into a classroom where he kills all 19 kids and two teachers. The police arrive at 11:44. They don't go in to the building, we understand, until 1:05. 11:54, the parents get so enraged, they start begging police to let them go into the building to give them their armor. What do you glean from the situation?
I mean, it's just so heartbreaking on so many different levels. We have a situation just a couple of years ago in Nairobi, Kenya. Christian Craig had, he's off duty. Well, not off duty. I mean, he's a part of the SAS, British SAS. He happens to be in Nairobi. A suicide bomber walks into the courtyard of a hotel, detonates, is followed up by multiple terrorists with AKs that enter the hotel and start executing people floor by floor. I had an American on my podcast, Maylee Chapin, who was in one of those rooms hiding for 17 hours. And she credits Christian Craighead for hearing that the suicide bomber go off, for hearing the gunfire, and for running to the sound of the guns. And as a single person enters that hotel and starts taking out those terrorists, he ran to the sound of the guns in an in extremis situation. And she credits him with saving her life and hundreds of others. So that's what a situation like this requires. It requires that you run to the sound of the guns. And I mean, you have to do that. But regardless of what people think about Second Amendment issues and all the rest of that, while people debate that in this country, in the meantime, we can harden these targets. We can make them harder. We do it with our airports. We do it with banks. We do it with jewelry stores. Politicians are surrounded by 24/7 full-time security. We can do that to our schools. We can make them hard targets. And for whatever reason, we neglect to do that. And then we can also give police officers a little bit more training. And they should be thinking about this. So the first time they think about having to enter an area where someone has barricaded and has hostages, especially children, it shouldn't be on the day that it's happening. They should be thinking about that ahead of time. They should be training for that ahead of time and know that their job requires them to run to the sound of the guns and take action. So it's I mean, it's heartbreaking all around. But in the meantime, as the country debates certain issues, we can harden our schools and make them harder targets.
Right. We'll debate it. Here's what Senator John Cornyn said. It looks like he's getting together with Republicans, the Democrats, and try to work something out. Cut 21.
I think there's a sense of, you know, urgency that maybe we didn't feel before. We're going to try to work through this and see if we can find that common ground. That's what I think our goal should be.
So what do you think? What would you think would be acceptable for gun users?
Yeah, well, the common ground should be to harden our schools. Well, these guys.
Number one. We agree with that.
Yeah, number one. Absolutely. Like, that is.
Would you raise the age to 21 to buy an AR-15?
No. You know, you can pick out certain things here and there always and have more laws on the books. We have so many different laws on the books already. But hardening our schools, for sure, making them harder. If someone keeps breaking into your house time and time again, or someone keeps coming in, let's say you have a large family, keeps coming in and killing one of them, how long is it going to be until you harden your house, until you get armed security, until you put up gates, until you put up lights, until you put up cameras, until you train your family what to do when this happens, until you start carrying concealed to make them go somewhere else. And,
right.
And look at you not as a soft target, but as a hard target. You know, signs that say this is a drug-free zone or this is a gun-free zone, don't do much of anything. All it does is make sure that the law-abiding citizens aren't there to save the day when they need to be. In fact, it's a magnet for people that want to commit these kind of crimes. So
understood.
It's heartbreaking and it's unforgivable.
Let's talk about your book, In the Blood, a thriller. It's the fifth one in your series, and it's James Reese is in the center of the action. Set the scene.
That's right. This is a sniper-centric novel of violent resolutions. And there's some unfinished business in the last few novels that gets taken care of in this one. But it's the fifth in a series. The first one is being turned into an Amazon Prime video series this summer, dropping on July 1st, 4th of July weekend, starring Chris Pratt, directed by Antoine Fuqua. And it is amazing. I could not be more thrilled with how that turned out. But this latest book just hit the New York Times list at number one, debuting there yesterday. So that was fantastic. And it's people's favorite thus far. So that makes me feel pretty good. But this one right here is it's very personal. It's very emotional. And other than the theme of a sniper-on-sniper type of engagement, without that trope of two snipers on separate hillsides or buildings that are looking for each other at the same time and shoot at the last second. I needed to write a sniper-centric novel that didn't have that scene, because that scene's been done. And as much as I love it, I had to figure out a way around that one. So there's also a theme in here that's of forgiveness, which is a little strange, because that one appeared as I was writing. But don't worry for anybody listening out there. I'm not joining the Oprah Book Club anytime soon. There's plenty of explosions and vengeance throughout. So yeah, just couldn't be more thrilled that this thing debuted at number one. And that's all due to people taking a risk on me, reading it, and telling a friend. So thank you to everybody.
And knowing, Jack, that you lived it, a lot of this stuff, your firsthand experience and the context you have to bring some authenticity to these stories, I think goes a long way. It's called In the Blood, a Thriller, the fifth in the Terminal List series. Jack Carr, congratulations. Thanks for your insight. You can also follow him at Jack Carr with two R's USA. Thanks, Jack.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Take care.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. When we come back, we'll open up the phones and get your take on the timeline as we know it. We're about to get more information, and then we'll share them with you. And then, what are you on board with? Whether you are a grandparent, parent, a kid, how do we harden the target and make school safer today? Brian Kilmeade Show.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm appalled at what I believe has happened, or at least what we think has happened so far. The fact that, look, for 12 minutes, the shooter was outside shooting. And then he went into the school, and 4 minutes later, police respond. But they were ill-prepared for the attack. They didn't have body armor. It doesn't appear like they had rifles and the ability to get into the classroom and stop the killing. So they sat outside for what appears to be 40 minutes waiting for a tactical response team to come in and address the threat.
So that is Ryan Petty, whose child was killed in Florida when they had those rampages at Stoneham High School. And we thought that the cops waiting on the outside was a disaster. It was disastrous for the survival of a lot of those students, because the shooter was able to go back and forth and just finish off some people that were wounded and weren't dead yet. Joining us now, actually, let me open up the phones. Bill is listening in Pennsylvania, WTRW, to talk about this. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Brian. I just want to wish you a great holiday weekend coming up. Bless you and your family.
Thanks so much. I just got to tell you, on One Nation for Memorial Day, we have Gary Sinise, who does more for troops than perhaps anybody I know, except for, of course, maybe Dan Rooney, who started Folds of Honor. And then you have Tunnel to Towers, Frank Siller. They're three of our guests. But go ahead, Bill. What's on your mind?
It's about the NRA. My comment is, I'm an ex-NRA member, and I am a proud gun owner. I think going forward, even at this convention, wouldn't it be great if the NRA just announced that going forward, they're going to be the trailblazers that are going to take on security in schools and come up with innovative ways to prevent these shootings? Like, they take on a dual role, not only to be a gun advocate, but also be the ones that trailblaze the new ideas that prevent some of these shootings from happening. I think that'd be great for their image. It would prevent them from becoming the villain all the time, every time something like this happens. If they started a think tank and got together with some of the best security forces and just came up with,
well, I'll tell you what, Bill, I don't know if you heard our interview with Oliver North, who used to run the NRA. They have a program. They put $100 million into it, and it's out there, and it's from the research. So I'm not sure it's exactly what we need, but it would be a start, and they should play a role. But instead, they want to vilify. If President Biden comes down and starts saying Republicans do this and they're responsible, and Brie of his old rhetoric of deer is not in the woods with Kevlar vests, you don't need an AR-15, that just alienates people. So maybe this is going to get something done. It's two things. Mental illness, too. I want this red flag law to be put into play that if you're a wild man at 16 and you turn 18 and there's nothing in your background check because any problems you had at 16 do not transfer to adulthood, I think there's got to be an amendment for people that pledge violence when you're a teenager, that there should be a background. When you get a background check, there's got to be a red flag that says you got to take a better look at this guy. This guy could be a problem, like the shooter in Buffalo. I wonder if there's a way to implement that. Jamie, WVMT in Vermont. Jamie.
Thanks for taking my call, Brian. And I, last guy said, no, But, you know, if money is an issue, we're sending $40 billion worth of military equipment to Ukraine. And I just feel like, you know, 100% of the American civilians or citizens here would gladly send $1 billion to help train officers or train veterans to protect our schools.
Yeah, there's enough money here for that, and no question, and they'll be able to get it. And I don't think you have to deny the Ukrainians who are doing the fighting really for the entire West of anything that they need. You could do it. And especially the crap that we spend on and how much money we've been wasted, there's a national movement to harden our schools and make them safe. Pro-gun, anti-gun, doesn't matter. We all have the same objective. So the red flag,
that's
we can
right.
get behind. And number two, hardening the targets. And I love your idea of using retired military, because you just train them for more domestic use in elementary school instead of taking down an Iraqi mud hut. I'm all for, and I bet you they can make the adjustment. Donnie, WLAD, Connecticut. Donnie.
Hey, Brian, what's happening, brother?
What's on your mind?
Vets. I'm for the vets, too. It's backups, though. My idea is this. It's, you ever hear micromanaging? All these companies using micromanaging. Well, if the schools had a room set up where you have a monitoring system, okay? And if something's wrong or whatever, a door's ajar, a door's unlocked, or you want to monitor a hallway, you want to monitor a classroom, you can sit there, maybe two people, play two people for the day. It's an eight-hour day for school or whatever. And you can see what the heck is going on. And you can relate that outside to whoever, cops.
Absolutely.
Or whatever.
Donnie, I mean, do you know this system that I found out in Uvalde? They agreed. They actually did drills on this. And there's a master key that's supposed to be in a certain place that the cops know about. They go grab a key. It's the wrong key.
No, I'm not talking about. I'm talking about a monitor. People inside the school are employed by the school that can see who's coming through the doors, who's walking down the hallways. And if there is a door ajar, you know, it shows up. There's, you know, the technology is, you can use it to such an extreme. And then you have your backup vets or whoever you want. And then you can tell them what's going on. Hey,
obviously a video system like that would be great. That's something that should be talked about. I think everybody would work an extra day a week to provide the funds. And it's not necessary because we make so much tax dollars. We give so many tax dollars to provide the funds to harden every single school and make school shootings as old hat as skyjacking. We could do it. I'm convinced of it. Everybody's on board for that. My hope is Democrats don't see a deal getting done with the Republicans and then walk away from it because they want it as an election issue. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Thanks so much for being here. Don't forget to listen to and watch One Nation, 8 o'clock on Saturday, Fox News.
Live from the Fox News radio studios in New York City, fresh off the set of Fox and Friends, it's America's receptive voice, Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being there, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. We know you're getting set for Memorial Day weekend. We got to finally not take anything for granted any of these holidays when you can be outside, be with family, and not have anything canceled. I understand in the New York area, the Blue Angels are going to do what they always do and over Jones Beach. That'll be fantastic. Jones Beach may be the finest beach in the country. And then in New York, too, if you look around where we're at, gas is probably going to be around $5 a gallon on average. $4.59 last year, $3. You believe this? But 82% of Americans are planning to travel this Memorial Day. 51% are carpooling. I'm not sure if that's an Uber carpool, but first things first. We'll discuss that. The President of the United States on Sunday will be in Uvalde, where the horrific shooting took place, killing those preschoolers, 19 of which, 21 in all, 19 kids between 8 and 10 years old. Just a quick note here. Talk about the fear among law enforcement is why Suffolk and Nassau County and Long Island have really responded with force. Suffolk County police have arrested, that's New York here. If you look at Long Island, probably it's the 20th biggest market in the country. Suffolk County police arrested a 16-year-old Bellport High School student after allegedly making online threats of a massive shooting at his school. The teenager who has identified his identity is being held. Obviously, he's under 18. He said multiple people called 911 about the May 26th threat So they've detective. They picked this guy up. It happened the day after we found out about the Uvalde shooting that took the lives of these innocent kids. So before we get to our first guest, who's going to talk about how to talk to your kids about this horrific crime, and Lee Greenwood at the bottom of the hour, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three. Sponsored by LifeVac. Save a life in a choking emergency. Visit LifeVac.net to learn more and use code BK10 to save 10%.
Number three.
What we now have is a very clear pattern in both the Steele dossier and the Alpha Bank scandal. Both of them originated with the Clinton campaign, but it went over to the FBI. Apparently, according to this agent, James Comey and the rest of the FBI were chomping at the bit.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, right? Which is the revelations from the Durham trial. Well, it wraps up. The defendant, Mike Sussman, decides not to take a stand. What we know about the trial, what we've learned because of the trial, and Durham chances of getting conviction. We'll talk about it.
Number two.
We are going to extend a hand of partnership to those who have been sitting on the sidelines, to those who have chosen to side with the gun lobby.
I think there's a sense of urgency that maybe we didn't feel before. We're going to try to work through this and see if we can find that common ground.
Yeah, that is a little different than Chris Murphy wants. He wants to say the NRA is holding the Republicans hostage. Not the case. Is this the time we look at guns and school safety? Bipartisan talks underway through Memorial Day. We'll keep you up to date. I want to find out what you think should be in or out of this.
Number one.
Multiple witnesses that I spoke with said as soon as they heard gunshots, they immediately jumped in a car, got to Robb Elementary, and that's where they were met with law enforcement. They couldn't get into the school. Multiple parents told me that they were frustrated by law enforcement inaction and don't understand why it took so long to get to the shooter.
Jorge Ventura, Daily Caller reporter. It's a lot of questions. Funerals begin today for 19 grade schoolers and two teachers, which is beyond sad. But what I know about the timeline is taking down the killer has me beyond mad. We're going to talk about this and elaborate on all this stuff and why we were told such inaccurate things for the last 2 days. Let's bring in Dr. Michelle Borba. Dr. Michelle Borba is the perfect person to have right now. She's an educational psychologist, best-selling author of several books. Her latest is Thrivers, The Surprising Reasons Why Some Kids Struggle and Others Shine. Dr. Borba, one thing is pretty clear. No matter what your grades are, if you're a kid watching this or experienced this shooting, this carnage, you are going to be forever affected. Can you give us an idea in what way?
Multiple ways. Number one, we've got children who we do know, 1 in 3 is already having some kind of a mental health problem during this pandemic. That means their stress and anxiety is already going up. But the second thing that we're worried about is what an incredible psychologist discovered a long time ago. It's called mean world syndrome. And that is if you continue to see the world in your view as a mean, scary place, and you only see the bad of it, your entire image of the world the rest of your life becomes more pessimistic. And that's going to really erode your confidence, your happiness, and your view of the life. And that's, oh God, our children deserve a heck of a lot better, don't they?
I would think so. So now we find out this 18-year-old went and targeted an elementary school like Sandy Hook, like the Sandy Hook shooter did, Adam Lanza. And we don't know much about this kid yet, but he walks into the school, locks himself in a classroom, and kills everybody in it. We know some of the horrific stories from these kids, and more will emerge. One said, my friend got killed, and I wanted to give the gunman a sense that I was shot at least. So I took some of my friend's blood and wiped it on myself. And he ended up walking past me. I mean, think about what that kid's life is going to be. I think, 9 years old.
Yeah, we're talking post-traumatic stress, obviously, and it will erode their image of the world forever. Each one of those children clearly needs major, major help right now in terms of counseling. But also, look at that child. What a brilliant kid. To be able to come up with a plan at that moment and still be able to think when you're in absolute terror mode.
And how about this?
Hear stories.
And how about the fact that she took her teacher, who was shot dead, took the teacher's cell phone, and then called 911?
Yes. Yes. Those are the kids who we do know have the skills who are coping and resilient. But what we now need to do is wrap our arms around all of our kids to be able to keep them calm and safe, because Yes, those children are there exposing right there in that moment. But we're also realizing in today's digital world, almost every one of our kids also has access to those images, and they are repeated images. The one thing I'd caution a parent is be very careful about a young child, because we knew after 9/11 that when images kept forming of those planes going into the towers, many young children thought those were continued kinds of attacks. So the first thing is we got to stay calm for our kids' sake, and we've got to listen to what they know or hear what they know and make sure that we are giving them the information, because a lot of the information that they're hearing is, believe it or not, actually far worse than what you're seeing, if that's even possible. But that's what's happening with children's little minds. They can't process this information.
True. You have a model. It's an acronym, TALK. And each letter of TALK means something. Number one with the T, talk about the tragic event. So if you're the parent of a kid, or since it's so relatable, since you look at these kids and say, that could be my classmate, my friend, an 8-year-old finds out that kids were targeted, they can't get their head around the fact that an adult would want to kill a kid, and they're hearing these stories. How do you get a kid to talk that wasn't even directly involved in this?
The first thing is children mirror us. And they're going to be far more likely to open up if we're calm ourselves. It's not a face-to-face conversation. Maybe it's sitting down next to a child. With boys, we know, young ones in particular, if you do something like play Legos or you're shooting baskets or something like that, they're more likely to open up. Second of all, you may start the conversation with, what are your friends saying? What have you heard? As opposed to start, how are you feeling about this? Just a more indirect version. What you're trying to do is just help your child open up to you so you can hear where he is and help him process this information.
Yeah, so the next one is assess, which is the A. Assess how the child is coping. You know your kid, right?
You do. The fascinating thing about this, Brian, is that every child, we're shocked that every child handles these things differently. And many parents are telling me, I didn't expect him to be so verbal, or I didn't expect her, she's always so verbal, to retreat. So keep tuning into your child, assessing how they're coping, not just now, but we're finding that some kids, it takes a couple of days for them to all of a sudden be stressed. And you may not realize that the reason that they are becoming angry or frustrated or stressed or irritable or reticent or pulling back, you don't know how your child is going to cope. You just keep tuning in, and you'll be able to help your child be able to slowly be able to process this information and handle it in a way that they don't feel quite as stressed. Are you watching your child, for instance, lose sleep? Are you seeing a change in eating behaviors? All of a sudden, she's more clingy. She doesn't want to go out or leave. I don't want to go to school, Mom. Those are kinds of things that could be red flags. Changes that are different from your child's normal are also changes that you should be tuning into.
You know, the good news is places like Florida, they're done with school. And in New York, they're going to be done in a couple of weeks. I mean, that school in Texas was about to close. They just had their graduation. Maybe that's why the door was open, some have speculated. But in New York, had a few more weeks. So the kid, your son or daughter might turn around and go, yeah, I'm not going. I'm not safe. And that brings us to the next one. Listen. Listen to the concerns they have. Hear them out.
Listen, and I think the key on this one is honor silence. Because very often what happens with younger kids, or even a teen, they're trying to process some extremely difficult information. So are we, for heaven's sakes. But for a child, he can't get his grasp on what the heck is going on. So your model is almost talk, then stop and push pause and listen. Then talk and stop and push pause and listen. This is also not a one-time marathon conversation. You want to have short little conversations for younger kids. You make it age appropriate or maturity appropriate. But you say, I'm always here for you. Let's keep talking about this. When you hear something, let's figure this out. Monitor that news. Please monitor it carefully. Tune it off. Turn it off. We do know that middle school kids, fascinating, we thought they were okay. They say that one of the things after 9/11, it was They couldn't stand the late-breaking news that was all of a sudden coming out. Here's a new thing that we just heard, without an adult sitting there calmly helping them process it.
Right.
So they may not be asking you. You just need to be empathetic and tune into, this is what my child is probably feeling or probably needs right now. Your calm presence is the key.
Dr. Michelle Borba is our guest, educational psychologist, talking about how to talk to your kids about this and adults. And lastly, you have Kindle. Hope that despite the horror, life will go on. Let them know life will go on.
Yeah, we learned that if you can do, it's called altruistic suffering. It sounds so lofty, but it actually does help. If a child can do something, for instance, the Parkland kids, what you saw them do was get out there and mobilize. They were part of a school shooting, but you saw many of those kids became active. They said it didn't stop the pain, but it helped a little bit. In certain cases, it may be, what's the tool that's going to help your child cope? Do you pray at night together? Do you pack some teddy bears and send them off to the child with your child? Do you plant a tree? What's the ritual that's going to help your child? Because what we do know also is if your child can help you, you can figure out some ways to cope now. Your child will be able to use those same strategies, Brian, the rest of their life to help with grief.
So we watched this Buffalo shooter plot and plan, and he already was interviewed by the state officials, and they said, you know, when they found out he was trying to threat to blow up his school and kill himself, he got evidently after 2.5 hours of analysis, they thought at 17 years old he was okay. They were wrong.
Yes.
And at 18,
yes,
he publishes a manifesto of 180 pages, and he goes up and plots and plans to shoot as many black people as possible up in Buffalo. Two 18-year-olds attack in the last 3 weeks. How do we stop this action? What are the red flags, not just for gun use, but to know that that kid is not only different from the other kids, he's not only quieter, but he might be a killer?
Here's what we do know. Unfortunately, I've been studying school shootings since Columbine. The FBI and the Secret Service have done the best reports on 38 school shooters, and they found that there's not one profile, but we do know something about them. And that is, it's a slow, gradual process where a child learns the stages of what criminologists call violentization. The step one is that you don't have that strong, accurate integrity or empathy, and it starts to wane. Many of these kids, believe it or not, were, in fact, three-fourths of them were bullied along the way. Nobody stood into them. I'm not giving them any credit for anything in life here, but that bullying can make a difference, and we need to stop that at a very early age. If we start to hear kids planning or saying things, I'm going to kill someone, for heaven's sake, take it seriously. Almost every one of these kids, you'll notice even this last one, do report and they do tell. Now they are reporting and telling on Facebook, on text, and we need to be able to get Facebook, all of our online sources, to be able to look at those and red flag them, and do not wait, because that is one of the protocols of a killer. They want notoriety, and at that point, they are meticulous in their planning. This is never an overnight concept. They plan.
Interesting. Dr. Borba, the other thing is that, well, okay, a 17-year-old, he's a little one, you know, his classmates knew he was a little different. Some looked at him and said, man, that guy's got a screw loose. That's a pedestrian term, not something you would use. This guy's a little dangerous. He makes me weird. He makes me eerie to be around him. And then he turns 18. And whatever problems and analysis he went through, because other people had concerns, it is expunged. And then when he walks down, because I say he, because almost all guys, when he walks down to the gun store, they look at his background check, and you know what? Okay, I'm going to sell you your first gun, we think. And they sell him the gun, and then he ends up being the Buffalo shooter.
Yes, you and I are on the exact same page. At one point, what we've got to do is start connecting the dots. And that is, the school will be able to see some of these. The counselor will be able to see some of these red flags. But can they report to the police? Yeah, in some states they do. The problem is that we do know in some of our past shooters, the police couldn't report to the school. We've got to start connecting the dots at an earlier age, because what we are still doing is intervening and not preventing. We have got to be a heck of a lot more proactive.
Right.
We do know that all of this can be prevented, that empathy seems to be a core piece of it, and it's a slow slippage where a child starts losing that, so humanity no longer is part and parcel. It's that apathy and complacency, and they're no longer seen as human beings.
And for 2 years, they've been, in some cases, if they don't have a secure family they've been alone. And they're even more of a shut-in because of the pandemic.
Yes.
Dr. Borba, we can go on for an hour and still not cover everything, but I think you help people a lot. Dr. Michelle Borba, thank you.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
You got it. When we come back, your turn, 1-866-408-7669. We still have not talked about the Durham report and Lee Greenwood at the bottom of the hour.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
According to the information I have, he went in at 11:40. He walked, and I'm going to approximate 20 feet. Turns left into a schoolroom, into a classroom. Officers are there. The initial officers, they receive gunfire. They don't make entry initially because of the gunfire they're receiving. But we have officers calling for additional resources.
And the problem is they waited outside an hour, and that's what it must have been, felt like a lifetime, maybe quick. To the families, it was way too long, and to me, on first blush, it was my kid in there, and I even think about it, you got to be able to go in. And the more police officers I talked to, even if they didn't have the elite training, you can't wait. They had to wait an hour for BorTech to get there, the elite Border Patrol guys. They ended up going in there with at least four, a stack of four behind a shield, and they end up taking this guy out who was shooting away. So Robb Elementary School, the Facebook post was out there at 11:43. It says the school's under attack, and local police arrive on the scene 11:44, and he wasn't taken out until 1:06. Parents were begging police to go in 11:54, and you see that on video. In fact, they stun gunned some of the parents that refused to listen.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
There's pride in every American heart, and it's time we stand and say that I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that life to me, and I gladly stand.
We are a talk channel, and this is a talk show, but when you have a guy like Lee Greenwood in studio, to set the table, we go to the most iconic song, maybe Behind the Star-Spangled Banner. It's the most patriotic song ever written. Lee Greenwood is here, country music singer, you know, and he just was able to sing that song, Proud American, on our show just a short time ago, and here he is. Lee, welcome.
Thank you very much, Brian. Great
in to be studio, here with you. This is a rare treat.
Thank you. This is cool. I don't think I've been in this studio before. I've done Fox Nation several times, but not in the studio with you.
Right. No. I'm honored and privileged. They just kind of built. They did this. They have the whole radio. They have Channel 115 on Sirius, which is 24-hour news, national news, kind of like the 1010 wins locally. So they built this whole thing for the talk studios too. So it's relatively new because the pandemic hit. And everyone left.
Oh, the pandemic. Oh, my gosh. You know, we're going to be traveling out of the country here shortly, and there's still some countries where we're going that require masks. And it's like you kind of forget after a while when the mask is gone. It's like, well, whew, it's over. But it ain't over. I mean, still other countries, you know,
how did you deal with it personally and professionally?
I hated it, first of all. And particularly we flew to Africa for our family vacation last year. We had to wear the mask from the time we left Nashville through New York, through Paris, and France was more picky about the documents we had to fill out for COVID than Kenya. And we got to Kenya, and there was no mask. It was fine there, but it was 24 hours of constant mask through the airplanes, you know, and the airports. It was awful. In 2020, of course, we had about 6 or 7 shows, most of them outdoors and most in the West Coast. So that was kind of hard keeping our talents up, you know, during that year. Began to get a little better in 21. And, of course, we're back full strength now.
Right. So, for the most part, I went to 2 or 3 events. It was packed merely for the first time. And I realized the trains aren't back. I'm able to get a seat on a train even if I go a minute before on Long Island Railroad. Subways aren't close. And mainly that's crime. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a crime thing.
Yeah.
Do you notice New York a little different now or no?
No.
Well, you just come in and out so quick.
Yeah, I come in and out. But it seems normal to me, except for the fact that during the riots when they closed all those expensive stores, my wife is really pissed off.
Right.
You know, all of those expensive stores that the glass knocked out and they didn't reopen, a lot of them down on Fifth Avenue. And I'm like, well, that's too bad, honey.
You know? A couple of things. Lee, you were just telling me about your childhood.
Yeah.
Anything but easy, right?
Well, you know, let me just say this. It was perfect. My father joined the Navy after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. I was born in 42, so he was deployed by the time I was born. My mother divorced him because she didn't understand his commitment to the country and to the service. Now, a lot of families went through that, but that left my mother with two kids, my older sister and I. And my sister is still alive, lives in Boise, Idaho, is 3 years older than me. And my mother was a piano player at night. She was a comptometer operator for Standard Oil during the daytime and a cleric for Southern Pacific. So holding down three jobs, I rarely knew her. I didn't know my father till I was in my teens. But I was raised by my grandparents. We were sharecroppers, lived on a farm in Sacramento, California. I worked on a farm as a kid, you know, growing up. I had a great childhood, great role models from my grandparents, and I didn't really want for anything. So if you say that I didn't
have— You didn't have a typical nuclear family, but you had a great grandparents.
And that's all it takes is love.
Right.
Really?
When did you realize you had musical talent?
5 or 6, 7, right in there.
How?
Well, I sang in church, and I think that's it. When you first realize you can carry a melody, and then you learn songs off the radio just quickly and start singing along with them. You only had, you know, the old radio with the two knobs on it.
Right.
Like, you get to hear some music occasionally. And my grandmother loved the music of the Canaries, Hart's Canary. We had a 78 vinyl record, and she would listen to that, sit in the chair, and I would try to memorize. The first song that I ever memorized was from a 78 record. It was Stan Kenton, the father of American jazz. It was called Artistry and Rhythm. And we had a spinet piano in the trailer that we lived in the corner. And I was allowed to play that piano every night after I finished my chores and my schoolwork, and I memorized Artistry and Rhythm. I still remember the melody. And I got all four parts in my head. I was 8, 9,
wow.
10.
Then they realized, too, we got to, like, support this. But and you end up going to – you went to camp, you said, too, right?
Well, I mean, it wasn't really support, but my grandmother took charge of my career in such a way – and there was fights between my mother and my grandmother about how much leeway they would give me. They really had a strong leash on me. But at the age of 13, 14, I was already playing in nightclubs. And so my grandmother would have the band leader. He'd come and sit in the living room. And we had this Spanish – I would say – let me just call it what it is, a Mexican bass player. And he had Hard Luck tattooed on his knuckles.
Ah.
A big fella. And she said, if he doesn't come home by 2 a.m. in the morning, he'll never go with you again.
Right.
And I was very good on the saxophone. And it was in those years, they had all those rhythm and blues quartets, and every one of them had a tenor saxophone in it. And I was already pretty good at it. And so I would finish, get home, have breakfast downtown North Sacramento, get home in bed by 2:30, be up at 6:30 and go run the baseball track at school.
So you're an athlete, too. I was saying the first thing that hit me before I met you, this guy's an athlete. You're in great shape.
Well, thank you. And at 79, I still feel pretty darn good. I've had a few surgeries on my knees and back, but that's just structural damage from sports. And I wouldn't give a minute of it. I love my baseball. I love basketball. And I played racquetball for 12 years.
So. But I didn't mean to interrupt you because my dad was in a quartet, too. I guess he would have been about the same age. He put a band together and paid his way right through college. He had an opportunity to go to Juilliard. But his parents said, no one makes a living in music, so did not support it. He ends up being a chemist in Iona, but played his music to support him through. One of his big regrets was not following through with that. And after he put down the clarinet and saxophone, he knew how good he could be. He hated picking it up again.
Well, you know, I've got a 23-year-old just graduated TCU in Fort Worth, Texas. He'll play piano, scare you to death. He looks a lot like Van Cliburn. As a matter of fact, there's a Van Cliburn room and a contest at TCU in Fort Worth, and he's elected not to do that because he wants to be just a writer. So he was a Chancellor Scholar because he had a perfect SAT score and science score in high school, and he changed from music from theater to musical composition. So he's going to write music for video games and motion pictures, and he's very well qualified. So I think his master's might be in Scotland or somewhere, but he's going to be a musician. I'm like, son, it's going to be tough, you know. But you can't deny the talent. If I figured he didn't have the talent, I would have deterred him. And his brother is actually pretty talented as a singer, who's now getting a PhD in cancer research at Vanderbilt. Wow. Dalton, who's 27 and just got married. He's his future secured. But I just said to Parker, you know, it may be tough. He said, it's all right. I'm ready for the long haul.
Right. So when you started in music, I mean, most people don't make it in music, right?
Well, you're right. Yeah. It's grab the brass ring. You're really lucky. I had 2 or 3 shots at it. Brian, you probably don't know this. I was working at a hotel called the Desert Inn in Vegas, and I was working for a female star named Babette DeCastro. And when we traded, every 40 minutes, you get a different act on. The other act was called Sandu Scott and the Scotties, and they'd put on their show, and 2 female acts. So when I finished Babette DeCastro's act, I joined the other band. We went to Puerto Rico, then New York to do the Ed Sullivan show. So it puts the time frame right for you. So now that was his. And so the drummer, Dino Danelli, lived in Hoboken. So I stayed with them. At that time, New York had Joy Dieter and the Starlighters had a new song called The Peppermint Twist. I would come to New York. We see them. It's a dead of winter. I'm getting pneumonia. And I said, guys, I just can't stay in New York. I got to go back to Vegas and go back to work. I did that. 3 months later, they put the band back together, and they became the Young Rascals. So I missed that gold brass. I missed that brass ring. It's interesting that Felix Cavalier wrote all those songs, now lives in Nashville. And he just did my 40 Years of Hits special, which Fox Nation carries, by the way.
You're being seen on Fox Nation right now.
Yeah, proud to be an American. And so Felix lives in Nashville. So it's full circle, but yeah, you're right. I'd say 1,000 to 1, maybe more, 10,000 to 1 if you get the brass ring. You know?
Right. But would you say your work ethic has a lot to do with it?
And oh, absolutely.
And did you have a plan B?
No.
Is that the key?
No.
No net?
Because
get
like
rid
your,
of the net?
Like your dad. I mean, I think there was opportunities. My stepfather was a contractor, Louis D'Antonoli. I loved him, and I could have went into building. I like that. I could have went into farmer work, but gosh dang, that's hard work. I mean, you may have to get up at 3 in the morning, but for a farmer, you're up at 3 and you're out in the field.
I end up in a makeup and a suit.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little harder. And I said, no, I don't want to be a farmer. And so and music came so easy, though. Oh, my gosh. But I was scouted by the Dodgers, and I thought, well, maybe baseball. But I was 140 pounds, dripping wet, 5'7". I'm not going to have a career in baseball.
Well, there were some guys your dimensions. Davey Lopes wasn't much bigger than that, right? Second base.
Well, sure. I mean, there's always that. I mean, Walter Payton. You know, I mean, there's always an exception. But I didn't want to be that exception.
All right, but you are exceptional. When we come back, Lee Greenwood tells us the story of God Bless the USA and where that song has taken you in your life and the presidents and officials you've had a chance to meet. Don't move. By the way, perfect guest today, Lee, not a coincidence, with Memorial Day a few days away. One of the many people in our country does not have to be told the meaning of this holiday. Don't move.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We're back, Lee Greenwood, our guest. Lee Greenwood was kind enough to do the Fox and Friends concert series, the first one to kick off today on Fleet Week. And, of course, God Bless the USA and Proud American is what Lee Greenwood is known for. You think about Lee Greenwood, it's Red, White, and Blue, but he's really a country music star, first and foremost. When you talk about that song that you played for us today, what has that done for your career?
Well, many people would say it's an umbrella. It is not. It's not a parachute, that's for sure. I'm an artist, I'm a singer and a writer, and I'll be that until I'm done. And God Bless the USA happened to be one of those songs along the way that I wrote because I wanted to write something about my country. But it was on the first album it was on was called You Got a Good Love Coming. We put $25,000 in that video and filmed it in the London Train Station, and Patrick Duffy was a guest as a cameo to open up that
Aquaman.
Video. Yeah. You can get that video on YouTube if you look for it. You Got a Good Love Coming. And so when we finished that album, we were actually recording in Nashville as a Nashville artist. We didn't want L.A. actually controlling what we do. And I was on the label with Reba McEntire, George Strait, the Oak Ridge Boys, and Barbara Mandrell. And we all had the same mindset. We are a Nashville artist. However, I was competing with George Strait for chart positions because his A&R man ran MCA. And so I was a little hard getting past his record. So I said, let's go out to, and have Get L.A. behind us. So we took that album, You Got a Good Love Coming, to Irving Azoff in Los Angeles and had them listen to it. It was him that made the choice to release God Bless the USA. It would never have been heard.
You think it would have been buried on that album?
Yeah. Yeah, it was just another song.
And then when you released, what happened?
Well, the power of radio, of course, you know, it was aimed at July 4th. They released it a little bit late. It went number six, I think, on the chart. And then after July 4th, the patriotism wanes, and then the song was not popular until it became Song of the Year in Nashville at the CMA, because it started getting legs. And as much as for the National Guard and the military as anything, because they immediately adopted me, you know, as their hero. And I did like 15 USO tours after I came to Nashville.
When did Reagan take notice?
The campaign for – I'm a Reaganite anyway. I'm from California, so I worked on his gubernatorial campaign I was a nobody. Yeah, and then they never forgot that. But, of course, when USA came out, they called me and they said, we want you to play the president's dinner for Ronald Reagan. So I did that, and then I did the 84 convention as well for Ronald. And I became Nancy Reagan's champion. And then we had a performance at the White House, and then I met 41, who was vice president at the time. And then I sang for five presidents at the Reagan Library. It was Reagan, Bush, Nixon, Carter, and Ford, wow, all standing behind me while I was singing. I was like, "Yeah, this is pretty awesome," you know. Wow. You had the Gulf War, and General Schwarzkopf used it as a song of the war, if you will. And then Katrina, it became a song for unity. And then, of course, the attack on America in 2001. And as you know, Brian, I was here three times: once for the Firemen's Memorial at Yankee Stadium, the Policeman's Memorial at Carnegie Hall, and then I came back for the fourth game of the World Series, which was kind of cool, the Yankees against the Diamondbacks, and the Yankees couldn't pull it out. The seventh game, they finally lost to the Diamondbacks in Arizona. But that was a part of rebuilding New York. But since then, there's just been more and more and more need for unity. And every time I do this, I come to New York and I sing for Fox, and we get, you know, on the network, and I have so many people coast to coast who have texted me this morning on my phone. It's blowing up. You know, it's like, oh, my gosh, we're so proud of you. You know, right, for getting there and singing.
People are worried about the patriotism still there in America. Can you compare it to the 1980s when, you know, we put the hostage crisis behind us? It becomes clear we're going to win the Cold War. Reagan was such an optimistic guy, wonderful speaker. He won by 49 states, right, for right, reelection. So can you compare the two generations?
Let me put it this way. In World War I and World War II, every household had somebody serving the military. I think when you move on to Vietnam, it was maybe every block had three or four soldiers. As you move on to the War on Terror, it's maybe 100 people in a city. So it's less and less people who see the value of the military, and therefore patriotism begins to wane. You have to remember how our freedom is protected. It's the military, and not enough people do that. So if you compare the generations, right, the respect for the country and the flag is much – if you're going to kneel for the flag, I suggest you go to church and kneel. That's where you'll find where your God is. And I hate it that the NFL is one of those that didn't step up immediately and say, you know what? I appreciate your cause, but this is not the place you kneel.
They went the other way. Lee Greenwood, our guest. Lee, when I thought about you too, when the statues start coming down. People now have a problem with Jefferson at William & Mary when he went to college. People are defiling George Washington's statue. I saw that they took down not exactly a founding father, but an iconic figure, Daniel Boone. They want his name off elementary schools. Lincoln. Teddy Roosevelt moved out from the Museum of Natural History. They took him off his horse, even though he and his dad built the Museum of Natural History. It was their idea. What do you think about when those things happen?
Oh, Brian, we're two white guys here talking on the phone. I sometimes, as I look back on it, you know, you have to have an African American in the culture in the room to talk about his culture and his perception of what's going on. I disagree with anybody that wants to remove a monument. I don't think that's the right thing. If you want to erect another monument next to it and say, this is my heritage and my perception.
Add a plaque to it.
Exactly. Let me just give my opinion. Okay, great. I'll take your opinion. But don't take down my history, because it's the history of the United States. I mean, you can't erase history.
So I did the President and Freedom Fighter, Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln, and the Battle to Save America's Soul. And at that same time, there's a protest around Frederick Douglass's statue, because the statue that the Lincoln statue that Douglass dedicated to Lincoln 10 years after his death had a African-American breaking free of chains. The best answer is what you just gave. Leave that statue. That's where Douglass stood. And then put one behind it.
Exactly.
Because even back then, Douglass was like, yeah, I don't love this statue. But he understood what they tried to do and was the slaves paid for it and okayed the design.
Yeah.
So that's a way to do it.
Absolutely. America's changing. It's again, every time we have, you know, like the shooting in Buffalo and it becomes racial. I know. It sets us back another 40 years.
Absolutely. But hopefully we move forward. Lee Greenwood, it's a thrill to have you here. I know you're going to have a big weekend. What do you want to promote real quick?
Black Cat Fireworks. Have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend and go buy some Black Cat Fireworks. Also, do our Adopt a Vet program. Come to my website, leegreenwood.com, and Adopt a Vet. You'll find out what it is.
All right, Lee. Thanks so much. Great to see you.
Thanks, Brian.
Bag it.
From the Fox News radio studios in New York City, fresh off the set of Fox and Friends, it's America's receptive voice, Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, coming to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. We're heard around the country, heard around the world, especially in the Ukraine. We're going to talk to Jack Curry at the bottom of the hour, studio analyst for Yes Network, two-time New York Times bestseller, and he's got a brand new book out called Swing and Hit, What 9 Innings of Baseball Taught Me. It's really about Paul O'Neill, but Jack Curry, a baseball aficionado in his own right. We need a little bit of a break, don't we? And if you happen to notice, the Yankees and many people in the offseason were saying, you got to tear this team apart. It's just underachieving. They made the wild card last 2 years. They don't hit in the clutch. It's an all-or-nothing team with an aging staff. They're the best record in baseball. Jack Curry on that. And Shannon Bream is going to be with us in a matter of moments. And I want her to break down not only what's happening in the world right now, but also what's happening with the Durham trial, which is really coming to a close. It's Michael Sussman. He is guilty as the day is long. Why? Some say he might get off. And also why it might not make that much of a difference. Intriguing, right? Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
What we now have is a very clear pattern in both the Steele dossier and the Alpha Bank scandal. Both of them originated with the Clinton campaign, but it went over to the FBI. Apparently, according to this agent, James Comey and the rest of the FBI were chomping at the bit.
Yeah, they couldn't wait to see the seventh floor. Durham trial wraps up. Sussman decides not to take the stand. What we now know about the trial, what we now know about the investigation, and how justice really should be served if Sussman is found guilty, because he was caught dead to rights, but why it might not matter.
Number two.
We are going to extend a hand of partnership to those who have been sitting on the sidelines, to those who have chosen to side with the gun lobby.
I think there's a sense of urgency that maybe we didn't feel before. We're going to try to work through this and see if we can find that common ground.
Yeah, Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut, you'll be tested, because Republicans will come to the table, if you're reasonable, on things that will help stop these school shootings. Is this time to look at guns and school safety in a bipartisan way? They will discuss it all throughout, and they'll Zoom it in a bipartisan way, and we'll see if they have a deal or if everyone's just going to play midterm politics.
Number one.
Multiple witnesses that I spoke with said as soon as they heard gunshots, they immediately jumped in a car, got to Robb Elementary, and that's where they were met with law enforcement. They couldn't get into the school. Multiple parents told me that they were frustrated by law enforcement inaction and don't understand why it took so long to get to the shooter.
We still don't. Jorge Ventura, Daily Caller reporter. Funerals begin for the 19 grade schoolers and two teachers who, it's beyond sad, will be laid to rest. And you know what gets you beyond mad? The fact that the killer was able to last an hour. Let's bring in Shannon Bream, Fox News legal correspondent, anchor of Fox News at Night, and the author of Mothers and Daughters of the Bible Speak, Lessons on Faith from 9 Biblical Families. Shannon, welcome.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Shannon, I don't even know. I mean, your show starts at midnight. You're reporting throughout the day. But I was supposed to go on with John Roberts and Sandra Smith. So I'm watching the whole press conference thinking it's going to be quick, but certainly impactful. I did not expect Victor Escon to say this. So many things that we thought were true that ended up not being true about the shooter. Listen to this. Cut to.
So right now, you know, during the investigation, it appears it was unlocked. So we're going to look at that and try to corroborate that as best as we can.
We also thought the shooter was confronted and was forced to drop a bag of ammunition. Cut one.
It was reported that a school district police officer confronted the suspect that was making entry. Not accurate. He walked in unobstructed initially. So from the grandmother's house to the bar ditch to the school, into the school, he was not confronted by anybody.
Killer kills his grandmother. She calls 911 with a bullet in her face. 11:28, the killer's truck arrives and crashes in the school. At 11:30, 911 call comes in. There's a problem. Ramos lingers around the shooter outside the school for 12 minutes, firing shots before he goes into the school unobstructed. Nobody was there, and the door was open. And it gets worse from there. Shannon, what's your reaction? We've seen so many of these school investigations. What do you think about the fact that we were so inaccurate for so long?
It's so puzzling. Listen, I can understand that you can say, we got to interview all these first responders. We got to debrief everybody. We got to figure this out. That I totally get. But the complete fabrication of a human being that wasn't even there, who allegedly exchanged gunfire with the suspect, that just is created out of thin air, is baffling to me, because we have the witness accounts who have said, we saw the truck crash, I called, people tried to go help the guy, he started shooting at them, we saw him going to the school. I don't know who invented the school resource officer. I mean, like we always say, the fog of war is obviously very, very confusing, and there's so much that we're going to have to unpack, and unfortunately that's going to involve talking to these precious little kids who survived this thing. But I just don't know how things get entered into the equation that never even existed. I mean, we had Lieutenant Olivares with the Texas Department of Safety on last night, and I said, let's walk through this. Let's talk about what you do know and how things came up that you didn't know and where you are now. And we talked about these parents who were furious, who have video, who showed up there. One woman says she was handcuffed. The marshals say it's not true. Another father was tackled to the ground. There are video of these things, of people hysterical. And there have got to be questions. If for no one else, for those parents, they deserve it. They have a right to it. And we've got to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, I mean, the way they were treated, I saw the video. You see him being stun gunned. And you also you see somebody being arrested when the parent tried to get on a bus to see their kid. And then there was evidently part of the timeline that's been accepted is 11:54, the parents start begging police to get into the building. At 106, Facebook shows Uvalde police and the shooter in custody, but he was never in custody. He was dead. They drag him to another room. He killed everybody in that room. So then the Bortec shows up, and they're the special operators with the shield that go in. The question is, and I've talked to people that we both know, that are police officers, they say you go in even if you just have a gun, Kevlar vest, and there's pictures on their website with tactical equipment. So I don't know where that equipment was at the time. Those questions have to be answered. But most importantly, Shannon, so how we handle it the next time? We're supposed to have learned a ton in 1999 from Columbine, but in some ways we don't seem to learn.
Yeah, because, we've asked and you have asked, I'm sure, many, many law enforcement experts and officers and people who served and are now serving in the field. Wasn't that the consensus after Columbine that if there's an active shooter or shooters inside and there are law enforcement people with guns on site, they go in? And again and again, they've all told me the same thing. That was the change. That is the policy. That's how you engage with the active shooter. If there are defenseless children inside, you don't wait. That's what we learned after Columbine. So there are just so many questions. Now, law enforcement will tell you, and people confirm on site witnesses, that they were working around to other classrooms, breaking out windows, getting kids out away from where they knew the shooter was. So it's not as if nothing was happening. They were evacuating people. They were doing everything that they could on that front. You know, what I was pressing on last night with Lieutenant Olivares is, but what about where you knew he was? And I asked him, I said, there have been reports that officers went in and engaged with the guy. Is that true? Do we believe that to still be true? And he said, yes, they were in the hallways trying to figure things out in there. They got engaged with gunfire and retreated from that point, but they did engage with him. So, but that's a full hour before Bortac shows up and goes in and takes him out. And people are still hearing gunshots inside at that point. And I cannot imagine as a parent how absolutely hysterical I would be for an hour, unable to find my child and hearing gunshots.
I will say this. This is what's been brought up to me by someone we both know, is that you go in That's what you're trained to do. Don't tell me you don't have trained enough or trained wrong. That's what you're trained to do. You know you're in the line of fire for everything from a traffic stop to something like this. There's always danger. That's the nature of the position. I'm not saying that I'm trained to do it, but that's one thing you know about cops. They put themselves in harm's way on a daily basis. That's why they get the respect they by so many. The other thing is you don't know how many of those kids could have been saved if we got to them right away.
Right. And that will haunt people because, you know, you have the account from the one little girl who laid on top of her friend and played dead and said her friend was still breathing for a while. And I did not hear that.
That is true. Yeah. That's the first time I'm hearing that.
Well, this is one little girl in an account, and I'm trying to remember which media outlet it was, but she actually survived, and she told her parents or told some adults that her friend was still alive. She tried to lay on top of her to pretend like she was dead, but that by the time it was all over, her friend had not made it. So whether she survived 30 seconds or 30 minutes, we just don't know. And that's, like I said at the beginning, the horrible thing is that these kids who survive this are having to be debriefed. But I couldn't live with that as a parent, thinking about my child maybe could have made it out.
Yeah, a couple of things, too. I mean, one thing, the grandmother evidently is awake, is not going to die, but is not getting out of the hospital anytime soon, is able to write things down. She might be able to fill in the blanks on what caused this, what the signs were. Evidently, he wasn't going to graduate. She wanted to take his phone back. He had a part-time job at Wendy's. He shoots her in the face, takes her truck, and then you know what he did. So the question is, two questions. I want to get to the Durham trial, too. But now, you know, we've been through this before, and now the Democrats are going to say it's all the NRA's fault and Republicans who are subservient to the NRA, which is an insult to all of our intelligence, especially if you know what happened to the NRA over the last few years. They're almost powerless in Washington. Josh Holmes said this about possible some bipartisan legislation. Cut 24, you know he's the former chief of staff to Senator McConnell.
But I think what this effort is to try to be responsive. It's not simply not enough to just sort of throw up your hands because there are good ideas that are out there. I think Republicans augur more closely to hardening security around the schools. Obviously, Democrats have had a longstanding want in the gun reform or, you know, gun control space.
Right.
And as these facts emerge, like I say, it is not irrelevant what the ultimate facts on the ground were in terms of how that bipartisan coalition comes together.
So bipartisan, we know that Mitt Romney seems to be in, Senator Collins seems to be in, Senator Cornyn seems to be in. They wanted to try to do something, but not gratuitously. Harden the targets across the country, provide the funding to do it. And red flag laws seem to have everybody intrigued, especially after these last two shootings.
Yeah, and listen, if there were easy answers, they would have figured this out a long time ago. So it's not easy. And, you know, like everybody thinks, and when you come to the table to negotiate over something like this, no one's going to get 100% of what they want. I think every single American is for anything they think would actually factually have made a difference in any of these cases. And that's the big thing. These people, this shooter was breaking multiple state and federal laws at the time this happened, including shooting his grandmother, including shooting innocent children, and some of them, many of them, still recovering. I mean, this is a psycho who was not going to go consult the law books. So then you talk about access, whether it's to guns or to the school. We had a mom on from Texas last night who said she, after, you know, Newtown was so determined to figure out how to do this, and she said, you know, they fought and fought in their community for one thing, main thing, was to get an armed officer at every single school. Then they fought for things like single point of entry and exit and other things that will make real difference in hardening this school. Because if somebody is psychotic enough, they will steal a gun. They will do any number of things that we've seen people do. So we have to look on all sides of the equation and see what would actually make a difference. Red flag laws, I think a lot of people want to investigate that and see how that could work. Unfortunately, I think with the Buffalo shooter and with the Uvalde shooter, I don't know that there was a criminal past or mental health history that was documented somewhere that would have triggered a red flag in either case.
Shannon, you're the lawyer, but evidently he did have a psychological interview because he's threatened to the Buffalo shooter because he threatened to blow up his school and kill him. I mean, shoot up the school and shoot himself. And after 2.5 hours with state officials, he turns 18 and still able to get a gun, nothing on his record.
Right. And I think that's the thing. If you don't have an official adjudication or something where you've been deemed to have a mental illness or a threat to society, if it's an interview, that's probably not going to show up anywhere. That's not, it's just not going to ping in a background check. But for these red flag laws where we talk about taking away guns from people who already have them, there's the big due process argument. In some states, they take the guns first and then you get a hearing. And listen, if you've got a kid or a neighbor or somebody who is, you know, not well, that sounds like a great idea, but you have to look all the way through this. What if it's you have a bad breakup and someone lies about you and says you're crazy and threatening them, and they
not
come
true.
And take your guns out of spite, or you know, a coworker who has revenge for you? And those are horrible decisions to try to make, because if we want to encourage people to step up and say, if someone seems unwell to you, let's get the guns out of their house. And so how lawmakers navigate through that and find something that's workable is going to be exceptionally difficult. But again, that's what we elect them to do.
I hear you. I went real quick over to the Durham trial. It's supposed to wrap up today. Michael Sussman will not stand there, will not stand trial. But from what you know, when Sussman's on text messages and says to James Baker, Jim Baker, the lawyer at the FBI, I'm coming just to represent myself. And then he talks about this Russian bank connection to Donald Trump, which ended up being nothing. And then he turns it over to be investigated. And they tell everyone, I cannot tell you who gave me this because he came here on his own. And that means that they start investigating this as legitimate, as opposed to somebody who works for the Hillary Clinton camp. You would think that that would be enough to convict Michael Sussman. But many people do not think he's going to be convicted because evidently the FBI used the Justice Department as a reference in order to move this investigation forward. That was also false. It kind of muddied the waters. What do you think, Shannon?
Well, and the fact that Durham, you know, showed the jury that he billed the Hillary Clinton campaign for that meeting at the FBI. I mean, there are a lot of things that seem to make Sussman's case for him, but you got to remember this jury. The D.C. area is heavily political. We know a number of the jurors either donated to Hillary Clinton's campaign or were supportive. You know, one of the folks has a daughter that plays on a team with Sussman, a sports team. I mean, it all comes down to the jury. That's in any case, whether you're in Paducah, Kentucky, or Washington, D.C., or anywhere in between, it's all about your jury. So I think, you know, we just got to see if people digest the evidence and come to the same conclusion or not. That people watching the trial from the outside, many of them have
exit question, Shannon. Even if he's found innocent, so much was exposed here of the erratic way in which they approached this, the unprofessional, agenda-driven way. Has Durham accomplished many of his goals?
I think that there's such a blackout on covering this trial that a lot of people will have no idea what Durham has presented.
An intentional blackout. Now, this is their choose not to pay attention to it.
In some squares, I would say yes.
Unbelievable. Shannon Bream, thanks so much. We'll watch you at midnight. Is that okay?
Yeah, but watch me on the 5 first.
Oh, yeah. Be on the 5 first, if you don't mind.
See you there.
All right, great. Thanks so much. Shannon Bream. Brian Kilmeade Show, thanks so much for listening. When we come back, I'll take your calls. And then we talk a little baseball with Jack Curry.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We have learned a lot. There's been questions raised as to why the Mueller investigation did not uncover or reveal some of these details. What we now have is a very clear pattern in both the Steele dossier and the Alpha Bank scandal. Both of them originated with the Clinton campaign. The Clinton campaign hid the funding of the Steele dossier. It was recently fined by the FEC for doing that. So they pushed these two separate parallel tracks. Both went to the FBI. Both went to the CIA. Both went to favorable people in the media. And they unleashed this torrent. And the response was, we just need a narrative. Well, you know what? The Clinton people were right. Because when it went over to the FBI, apparently, according to this agent, James Comey and the rest of the FBI were chomping at the bit.
They just wanted to make sure Trump wasn't elected. Why Robert Mueller, two-time FBI director, could not do that and figure that out, or Andrew Weissman, because he wasn't being honest. They said these guys are going to go where the investigation leads them. It should have been to a dead end. And we're seeing that. Pay attention to the Durham trial. Anybody that's on the fence with Trump and Clinton, or Trump and Obama and Biden, tell them just to take a look at this trial and the summaries that are in it and the conclusions that will emerge. I just hope Sussman's convicted so people don't have a reason to look away.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
They're chanting Paul O'Neill's name. These terrific fans here in New York. Paul O'Neill just bowed his head a moment ago.
That is the fans chanting Paul O'Neill as he said goodbye to his career. They'll put him in the Yankee, basically the Yankee Hall of Fame, into Monument Park. And that was in 2001. That was Game 5 of the Yankees World Series. With me right now is a man who knows all about that. He's friends with him, and he wrote a book with him. It is Jack Curry. The book is called Paul O'Neill, What 9 Innings of What Baseball Taught Me, Swing and a Hit. Jack, congratulations on another book.
Brian, I appreciate it. Always good to talk to you.
Yeah, and it's a great one. Of course, this is a great time to be an anchor on Yes, you might have noticed. The Yankees are putting together a season we no one expected. Am I right?
32-13 is hard to predict. I will say this. I had them for 95 wins before the season. That was my prediction. I thought they'd go to the postseason. But, Brian, in some respects, they have clearly exceeded expectations. I mean, the guy who pitched last night, Nestor Cortez, is a 36th-round pick who's pitching like an all-star. Their bullpen, until it got decimated with some injuries, I think had been the strength of the team. And then Aaron Judge is an MVP who was playing like an MVP.
What about the shortstop? What has he done?
Kiner Falefa is a contact hitter who is athletic and plays steady defense. And I think what they like about him, Brian, is the first thing I said. He puts the ball in play. He's not going to hit for power. He's probably not going to drive in a ton of runs. But for the most part, he'll catch the balls that are hit to him, give you some steady defense, and he won't strike out. And that's kind of what the Yankees are trying to get a little bit away from. And adding Donaldson and Kiner Falefa and then bringing back Rizzo, those guys are all above-average contact hitters. They've already got a lot of strikeout guys in the lineup. You need some guys to put the ball in play.
And Gleyber now is playing like he did 2 years ago, right?
He looks better. Everything is trending in the right direction for him. He's hitting the ball harder. He's hitting the ball in the air more. He's got 7 homers already this year. He only hit 9 last year. And it looks like, Brian, he's made some hitting adjustments. He's talked about both his lower half and the use of his hands more. And just seems like he's more comfortable at the plate. I think the shortstop thing hurt him last year. He's not a shortstop. I think being back at second base as well has made him more comfortable.
And no question. So you write this book of Paul O'Neill, now part of the broadcasting team. You know, obviously people who watch him play who are Yankee fans really appreciate him. They should know he started with the Reds. So before we even get into that, I think the first time I remember Paul O'Neill's name being mentioned, being that I grew up in New York, was when they asked Darryl Strawberry, how do you feel like being on the All-Star team? And he said, I'm not the best right fielder in the league. Paul O'Neill is. And I thought, Paul O'Neill? Because I haven't been watching much of the Reds lately. I'm like, who's Paul O'Neill? And he was a standout player when he was traded to the Yankees, already established, for Roberto Kelly, correct?
Interesting. Yes, Brian, you got it right. And it's interesting that you say that because there are some people who do want to forget about the Reds portion of his career. He won a World Series there. I interviewed all 4 of his managers for this book, including Pete Rose. Pete Rose glows and gushes when he talks about O'Neill and his athleticism and what he was able to do both offensively and defensively. And yes, he had a career before he got to New York. It's just that his New York career ended up being much more productive and profitable than what he did in his years in Cincinnati.
And so he wanted to play in the Reds, and he's surrounded by Pete Rose, the player. Dave Concepcion, the shortstop, right? I mean, Tony Perez was still around. The Reds still had the remnants of a great that legendary team.
Well, imagine, Brian, he's a kid who was born in the Midwest in the early 60s. And you're right, he's a teenager with the Big Red Machine when they win their championships. And then he debuts with the team in 1985. And you just mentioned some of the players, including Rose, who are still around. And in Chapter 1, we talk about him kind of being the accidental teammate because 8 days into his career, Rose breaks Ty Cobb's all-time hit record, and O'Neill is running out onto the field thinking, this guy's poster used to be on my bedroom wall. Now what am I supposed to do? Give him a hug? Give him a handshake? So, yeah, we cover a lot of his Cincinnati career in the first couple of chapters.
So he comes over to the Yankees, and he joins what would be one of the greatest runs in modern baseball history with this team who has 27 championships. And I believe Paul O'Neill won 4. Here's a moment, Game 5, 1996. The Yankees hadn't been to the World Series in so long. They finally get there and had to overcome a deficit to beat the Atlanta Braves. Here's a moment in Game 5, Paul O'Neill with a Game 7 catch with a bad hamstring, cut 41.
0-2 from Wendland. Into right field. O'Neill is there. Ball game. saves it for Andy Pettit.
O'Neal with that bad hamstring we've been talking about, full extension at the end of that play, comes up limping.
So he was an all-around player, great arm, excellent outfielder who hit line drives, right?
Couple of things, yes, line drives, but a couple of things about that play real quickly, Brian. First of all, anyone who was ever at a Yankee game, Paul O'Neill had this habit of, while he was in the outfield, of practicing his swing. Before that at-bat, Louis Polonia was the hitter. Paul was practicing his swing. It's the ninth inning of a World Series game. The Yankee coaches, Jose Cardenal, was trying to get in touch with him because they wanted to shift him about seven steps to the right. They finally got to him before Polonia hit that ball, and I'm telling you, if he does not move, Brian, he doesn't catch that ball. So, yes, Paul was an all-around player, and he's very grateful that he peeked into the dugout and made sure that he moved to his right to catch that ball.
Well, besides that, you don't remember much about the play. Jack Curry, our guest. So, Jack, the thing amazing, that's when Mariano Rivera was a setup man, and John Wetland was the closer, right?
I used to call those, I was working for the New York Times, then I used to call those games Little League games, because after six innings, if you weren't beating the Yankees, you lost, because it was Moe for seven and eight. It was Wetland who sometimes would make it a high wire act, but he would usually handle the ninth. You're right. I wonder if the Yankees might end up doing a little something like that this year. They got this kid, Michael King, who can pitch multiple innings, and you never want to compare someone to Mariano of 96 because that was off the charts. But I've thought that with this kid, King, we could see the Yankees in late innings letting him handle a seventh and an eighth.
Instead of Chapman?
Chapman, Brian, has really struggled. He's on the IL right now. I actually think when Chapman comes back, he should not be the closer. I think Clay Holmes, who's got a scoreless streak of 23 straight innings, your eyes and the numbers are telling you that Holmes is their best option to finish games right now.
Paul O'Neill, the name of the book is Nine Innings of What Baseball Taught Me. It's about Paul O'Neill. Jack Curry wrote it with Paul, and it begins, with Paul, with his relationship with his dad. His dad was a pitcher, but worked with Paul O'Neill about doing one thing, hitting line drives. And he said, and something else, parents listening right now, you got your kids in Memorial Day tournaments, baseball, soccer, lacrosse. He said he never lambasted him at any point, no matter how hard the loss or how bad he played. Dad always stayed positive with him.
Yeah, and Paul said, and he had a funny line. I mean, this is his line that's in the book. He said, I always look forward to get into the Ford Ranchero after the game because Dad was usually going to take me for some ice cream. So, right, there are different ways to coach kids. Paul's dad, and I know you've coached your kids, Paul's dad was about positive, was about optimism, and he was about having knowledge, Brian. As you said, he was a minor league pitcher. He knew what it took to advance to that level. And he told Paul when he was 5 or 6 years old, you're going to be a major leaguer. And Paul says, when your dad tells you that at that age, you're a kid, you're excited. But he said he truly believes that his father saw that kind of potential in him.
Very interesting. So he also said this, he learned to hit, and he would take tweaks, but he wouldn't change his swing. And Pete Rose was the same way. Lou Piniella tried to change Paul O'Neill, didn't he?
Yeah, we covered that in Chapter 2, and what happened with Lou and Paul, they both admit that they remind each other of each other. And Lou had a way that he thought somebody like O'Neill should hit, 6'4", 215. This big, powerful guy should get the ball in the air and hit more home runs. And he had some weight shift techniques that he wanted Paul to do with his lower half. That was not who Paul was. Paul was more, at least when he was in Cincinnati, kind of stood tall, wanted to hit line drives, hit them all over the field. So they ended up clashing. They did win a World Series together in 1990, but I interviewed Lou for the book too. And I think it was a case, Brian, of two really strong-willed hitting minds just didn't gel. They thought that the path to Paul being a great player, they had different ways to get to that path.
Yeah, and the other thing about Paul O'Neill, he was one of the few who Steinbrenner loved, right? Never would get under his skin.
God.
I know it was the last part of his life, but he just loved the way Paul O'Neill played.
Go back to 1997, Brian, and the Yankees get knocked out by Cleveland. But in the ninth inning of that final game in the postseason, he hits a ball off the wall against Jose Mesa. And he hit it so hard that he had to stumble and sprawl and kind of awkwardly dive into second to get a double.
In fact, hey, Jack, do you want to hear it?
Let's hear it.
Cut 43, game 5.
Into right center field. Grissom will not get there. Off the wall, off the bat of O'Neill. Trying for two. Safe with a double.
Paul O'Neill may be hurt. It looked like his right knee curled up under him on that slide. A brilliant slide to the inside of the bag. He didn't catch the bag with his feet. He caught it with his right hand.
So now you can paint the picture even better.
Wow.
Right?
Well, first of all, it's great hearing that. And Joe Buck and Tim McCarver all over it. Tim McCarver, phenomenal announcer. I think he added a little more elegance to what Paul's slide actually was. It was a all-out survival of the fittest. I've got to stumble and crawl and dive to get to this base before they tag me. Bernie Williams flew out after that. But the point of the slide was George Steinbrenner saw that. And from that moment on, he called Paul the Warrior. And we talk about this in the book, Brian. Paul didn't like that initially. He thought that it was a little hokey, a little cartoon character-esque. Why is he calling me the Warrior? And then the more people around him talked to him about it, they said, do you realize how demanding George Steinbrenner is? Do you realize that when he tags you with a name like that, where he is elevating you in his eyes? And then Paul grew to love it.
Yeah, of course. Tell that to Dave Winfield. He would have loved to have heard that, right?
100%.
Yeah. So here is O'Neill talking about it's the best season I've ever seen just in my lifetime. I was actually doing a lot of sports here at Fox News at the time. And it's 1998. The Yankee team just refused to lose. And then they just walked away with the World Series. I think it was San Diego that year, right?
They swept San Diego, right?
Yeah, I remember watching David Cohn did not leave the dugout, watched everyone else cheer. I never asked him about that, why he never left the dugout while everybody else celebrated. But they won it in San Diego. Here's Paul O'Neill talking about that team, cut 44.
In my mind, it was the closest to the perfect team that I was ever part of. A lot of teams are really good on paper, and then, you know, injuries set in, and guys don't have the years they're supposed to have. But all of a sudden, this season started. And then once we got going, I've never seen a team go into a city looking to win two out of three or three out of three. I mean, it's just like you would win two out of three and then you would expect to sweep and you would go on to the next series. It was really an amazing thing.
So, I mean, he loved talking about that team like everybody does, right? That's where Joe Torre takes over, Clueless Joe. It becomes pretty apparent that he is the right man at the right time.
Brian, you've given me a perfect segue. I know I popped on here to talk about Paul O'Neill and our book, Swinging a Hit, but I'm actually doing a book on the 98 Yankees that will be out in April because it'll be the 25-year anniversary of that team. So that's my next project. So
nice.
I appreciate you bringing that up.
You owe me a favor, Jack.
Exactly.
Jack Curry, our guest. So here's the thing. You picked a guy that people in Cincinnati and New York appreciate and opponents feared. I get it. But he didn't hit 500 home runs. He didn't hit 350. If you don't, even though his swing was compared to Ted Williams by his dad, and he had conversations with Ted Williams, and he had brushes with greatness with Rose and the Reds and with the Yankees, he's not the best player of all time. What made you think that Paul O'Neill's somebody I got to focus on?
Brian, you just talked about some of it. I think Paul O'Neill had a great career. And you're right. He's not a Hall of Famer. He would say the same thing himself. But how many players had over 2,000 hits, had almost 300 home runs, have 5 World Series rings, have a batting title? But then I hate to use this, but I use it because people will get the reference. He's got a Forrest Gump quality to his career. Was on the field within a week of his debut with Pete Rose's record-breaking hit. Saw Mariano Rivera and Derek Jeter as rookies, guys who were first ballot Hall of Famers, Mariano unanimously. Saw Joe Torre come in and get his first World Series ring after 30-plus years. You mentioned the connection with Ted Williams. And he's got the connection with the Big Red Machine. He and Bernie Williams, again, Bernie was a borderline Hall of Famer, not saying that Paul was, but there's so many ways we could intersect this book. And Brian, honestly, that's one of the reasons I was able to convince Paul to do it. He didn't want to just talk about himself, but when I said we can bring in all of these other people who impacted your career, that really interested him.
And I will say this, Jack. I didn't cover the team all the time, only when it became a national story. And my first job was Sports Phone. So I used to go into the locker room when Stump Merrill was coach of the Yankees. Yeah. And and Moss was the baby bombers back then. But I always found out Paul O'Neill was always in a bad mood. He always seemed angry at the media. Does he even does he talk about his relationship with the media? Why he outside the Jack Currys of the world and maybe the Michael Kays, he wasn't that pleasant ever?
We talk about that, and I describe a scene in 1994 where he's hitting 400 in the middle of June. Brian, that's a huge story. And if you're the beat writer, that's your story every day. And approaching Paul was tricky because he didn't want to talk about it. And he says in the book that I always used to tell writers, nothing I say to you before the game is going to help me get a hit in the game. I think he was so locked in that he didn't want to get in his own head about what he might be doing. Paul did believe that if you went to the plate with less clutter, you could be a better hitter.
Hey, Jack, congratulations. Another great project, another great book. Pick it up. Paul O'Neill and Jack Curry write 9 innings of what baseball taught me, swing and a hit. Good job, Jack. Thanks so much. And you to have a great season. I love watching you.
Thanks for having me on, Brian. Always good to talk to you. Take care.
Yeah, check out Jack always, every day on Yes. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Back in a moment.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
At some point today, we're going to get a very detailed TikTok up to the minute. Bill Malusian said, our reporter on the ground, that what happened to Uvalde at that elementary school a couple of days ago, as we get more and more details, and how bad that press conference was yesterday at 2 in the afternoon. The officer failed to even mention how many people they did get out through exterior windows. I mean, that would be something you would reach for, let alone, and people say, well, you overemphasize that. They chose to forget it. I want to squeeze another call. Paul in Boston. Paul, going to be talking about things to harden our schools and make sure this doesn't happen again. What ideas do you have?
Good evening, Brad. Good morning, Brad. I came out of retirement to tell you these three quick points. The FBI went to see the Parkland shooter 13 times. Monitoring is the illusion of preserving and protecting. People that are psychotic and sociopaths tell you what you want to hear. Adam Lanza walked into Newtown because his mom worked there. They just let him walk in. And putting the cop isn't going to work because they'll just shoot the cop right through his bulletproof vest and puts the police in danger. What Newtown did, it's time for the cities and the districts to recognize this. You have to create a one-entrance kiddie port, separate bulletproof doors in the front and the back with a hidden metal detector. If you go into one of our schools to kill one of our kids, you're not getting in. Brian, there's been 900 shootings since Newtown. The baby formula is locked up in the front of the grocery store. Our money's in a bank vault, but our most precious treasure, our children, are wide open targets.
That's a great point. Man, that was well put, Paul. Excellent way to end the hour. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. We all have the same objective. Let's see if we can get there. Keep it here. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.